Welcome to the Everyday Innovator Podcast for product managers and innovators. Your host is Chad McAllister, helping product managers become product masters. Listen and get ready to take your career to the next level, for the doctor is in.
Hi, this is Chad. Welcome to another discussion helping product managers to become product masters. Product masters have influence to create products customers love, and gaining that influence involves learning to think like a product leader, and that is what I am here to help with. A frequent question lately has been what tools are used by product managers and innovators. And in this episode, we're addressing some tools for innovation. I'll cover product management tools in a future episode. To discuss innovation tools, I talked to the one person, who has literally written the book on innovation tools, which appropriately is also the title of his book, Innovation Tools. My guest and best-selling author is Evan Shellshire. Evan's focus is on industry-transforming technologies and methodologies, from software to consulting. His background is in economics and game theory, and he's also the founder of Simultech, a company that leverages game theory to elicit people's true preferences. To get the summary of our discussion and also the resources mentioned during the interview, please go to theeverydayinnovator.com/113. I hope you enjoy the discussion. Evan, thank you for joining the Everyday Innovators.
It's a pleasure. I'm glad I can be here today.
I'm glad it worked out. And you are in Australia, and I am in Colorado in the United States. So we have a bit of distance between us.
Not with the technology that's available today. It just seems to be possible to do anything, doesn't it?
I know. Isn't it amazing? I've done a few international interviews and have a panel discussion coming up soon, which will be a lot of fun. So I'm glad that so far our technology holds out well for us. And some of this is the result of innovation. And you wrote about this recently in a book called Innovation Tools, which I'm very curious about. What was the background there? Why did you write this book?
Innovation Tools really, for me, was to fill a gap. Mm-hmm. For people out there who are well aware of things like the Lean Startup, what you'll find typically, and this arose in many conversations and a lot of work I did, was there's a gap between the theory of the Lean Startup and other such methodologies and actual execution. And what that gap revolves around, it revolves around, I understand the framework, I understand the methodology, I understand kind of the ideas behind what I should be doing, but what I'm missing are the concrete set of tools to make that a reality, and especially low-risk ones. So the Lean Startup is really about managing risk. It's a risk management right. methodology and framework to help people launch new ideas and companies in a low-risk fashion. And so what was missing was not just a set of tools to implement that, but a set of tools that were centered around low-risk activities and low-risk or risk-minimizing execution strategies. And so that's really was the impetus for my book. I wanted to fill that gap and help people find out what are the actual risk minimizing tools out there to help you implement something like the Lean Startup. It was really a lot of conversations around people saying, yeah, look, I get it, but I need to do something now, get my hands dirty, what's out there. And so that was the reason why I wrote that book, to help people with this important piece.
Okay. When I look at innovation, I often use a three-part model, and this is specifically to what product managers tend to deal with. And the first part I call ideation. It's called the fuzzy front end traditionally, where we come up with new ideas. The middle part is actually developing the product. In a lot of organizations, looks like some kind of stage gate process, or maybe a hybrid agile stage gate process.
Yep.
The third part is what happens after you launch, right? Managing that product lifecycle, you commercialize it. The set of tools that you address, since you made this connection to Lean Startup, I'm assuming now that they probably focus more on the fuzzy front end, that first part where we get ideas from. Is that the right place that these are?
Sort of. I'd say it's partially correct. So if I look at myself and think about if I were to give myself a title, put myself in a box, I would say I'm a product developer. Mm-hmm. And that's really where I see those tools fitting in. So the third part, these tools aren't as relevant. So that product lifecycle management, they're not going into that whatsoever. Mm-hmm. It's really about the development and launching of a product. So some of the ideas in the book touch on the ideation, the fuzzy front end. But I would say a fair bit of the tools are on the actual execution and the product development. So when you're going through that stage gate, if you're going to be applying a lean or an agile process, if you're going to be using some methodology to actually develop your product in any type of build, measure, learn scenario, what are the actual tools that fit into that build part that minimize or lower risk? That's kind of what it's about. But there are a number of chapters in there that will assist with the fuzzy front end. There are a number of chapters in there that will provide benefit for those type of activities.
Okay. Well, let's dive into some tools that are featured in the book. One I saw just kind of browsing through, and as we chatted earlier, so I try not to actually read books in detail with guests because then they're not new to me, and I like discovering this just as the everyday innovators listening are discovering it too. I do know a fair bit about crowdsourcing, and that's one of the tools you cover, and I want to get your perspective of what you shared in the book too. Can you tell us about crowdsourcing?
Crowdsourcing is one of those chapters where I really spent a long time thinking about should I include it or not. Mm-hmm. There are enough books and there's enough information out there about crowdsourcing, and really the question for me is what could I add that was new to that? And so this was the big challenge for me. It felt like I needed to put it in, but I didn't want to repeat everything else that was out there. And so I decided the end day, okay, I'll put it in there. I want it to be there. It's really important. In fact, the first chapter and the third chapter touch on crowdsourcing from different perspectives. And the reason why I feel crowdsourcing is really important, it's been a massive catalyst for driving innovation. Mm. We know that the crowd or everyone out there has a huge number of perspectives, expertise, different things like that can be contributed to a problem. And we've really seen lately some of the big successes have been able to tap into that expertise. And that's really, for me, what crowdsourcing is about. People out there in society have over their lifetime built up an expertise in some topic. And what you're doing with crowdsourcing, in my eyes, is you're tapping into that latent expertise, that desire for people who know something special to give you that something special. Hmm. And that's really the challenge and the benefit of crowdsourcing. It's really, can I get to that knowledge? Now, that's, I guess, one part of crowdsourcing that I look in my book, this important sort of tapping into problem-solving abilities, ideas, understanding and stuff like that. The other part of the crowdsourcing I look at is where you flip it on the head. Instead of reaching out to the crowd and saying, can you provide me with solutions, ideas, or anything, you reach out to the crowd and say, I've got an idea or a solution. Can you help me fund it? And so that was where, in my book, I tried to take the perspective of the bigger picture of all these types of crowd activities. So looking at how can the crowd assist, not only just with ideas, but also potentially with finance. And also looking at where crowdsourcing can go and where the future I see of it being in all sorts of things that are now being picked up around democracy and how the crowd can be much more active and involved in things like that to other issues around what are problems and challenges with crowdsourcing at the moment.
So let's talk about some challenges then. What have you come across for crowdsourcing that has made it more problematic?
Well, we've seen in a few cases where things like crowdsourcing can really go wrong. Mm-hmm. There's a thing called the crowd slap that I talk about in my book that's happened a few times where a number of companies like Chevrolet have tried to source the crowd for ad campaigns or different things like that. And because of the company's image in society, instead of people taking it seriously, they went and made fun and ridiculed the company. Mm. However, I really feel that the biggest challenge around crowdsourcing is managing the crowd and understanding and having the right expectations from the beginning. So in 2006, IBM ran their innovation jam, right?
Right.
And as a part of that innovation jam, they got 46,000 contributions, which they then reduced down to 31 ideas for further refinement. Now, that's less than 0.1% of all ideas contributed. Much like half of that, of 0.1%, were actually even used at the end of the day. Now, if we think that it took someone 5 minutes to consider every idea, right, then we're looking at about 160 24-hour days it required IBM to go through all those ideas, or about 480 work days, or roughly 2 years of time, of one person's time, to go through all those 46,000 ideas. Now, the question there for them was, would it have simply been better if we'd invested in our own people to come up with those ideas over a 6 months sprint and prototyping and development phase? I mean, this is the challenge, I think, with crowdsourcing. It's understanding what you're going to get out of it, what the work requirement is. Crowdfunding people who I run into all the time say, let's just run a crowdfunding campaign. I say, no. To run a successful crowdfunding campaign is actually a big challenge. You need high quality videos, you need to market the campaign, you need to do a lot of things. And sometimes it could just simply be better taking that money and developing what you want and going to an angel investor. So I think around crowdsourcing, people just need to have the right expectations and understand the amount of work involved in managing and successfully mm-hmm. running a crowdsourcing campaign and the appropriate relationship between the person doing the crowdsourcing and the people providing the ideas, which is everything around intellectual property to remuneration for their effort and all these different things. So I think they're where the major challenges lie. And to do a successful crowdsourcing campaign, you really need to have those under your belt.
And a lot of those same problems show up with the, we have automated ways of doing this now, but the employee suggestion box, right, where employees are providing ideas.
Yeah.
Again, if you're not setting expectations there and managing some kind of selection process and trying to be transparent and giving feedback to those who submitted, those systems kind of break down.
Exactly.
This has the added complications that you need to prepare materials to help the crowd know what it is you're trying to get done. And there's some expectations around the quality of those materials.
Exactly.
Did you look at specific tools for that, like the Kickstarter platform, in terms of a crowdsourcing tool to help find funding for an idea and that sort of thing? I was curious.
In what sort of respect do you mean?
I don't know if it was
in
a tool
you... tools to assist you launching a Kickstarter campaign or...
Yeah, I didn't know if you looked at, in the book, if you looked at, you mentioned platforms earlier a little bit for crowdsourcing, mm-hmm. about that being one tool on the other side of the equation when it comes to finding resources for funding.
Absolutely. So I look at a few of the different platforms that are online, Yet2, Nine Sigma, Innocentive. There are mm-hmm. quite a number out there. That help people launch crowdsourcing campaigns, that's not crowdfunding, that's more simple crowdsourcing and getting ideas in. Because one of the challenges around exactly what you said, managing expectations for a number of brands is they don't want to expose their brand to the crowdsourcing opportunity that they see there. So they might want to put up an anonymous campaign and launch that by Innocentive or some other platform. And that's definitely an important tool around that. Hmm. But Kickstarter and different crowdfunding, I think there are just multiple platforms and you need to, and I investigate two of them in my book, Indiegogo and Kickstarter. And the user of those different crowdfunding platforms simply need to understand what's best suited to their needs and their scenario. And I do describe them and provide a lot of extra information in the references as to where you can find more details relevant for your specific campaign.
I have an interview coming up in just a couple weeks. Well, this will confuse listeners. Sorry, everyday innovators. By the time this episode comes out, it will already have come out. But it was with one of the guys at First Build, which is kind of the crowdsourcing lab extension of GE Appliances.
First Build, yep. I think I investigate them at the end of one of my chapters at talking about taking it all the way through from crowdsourcing to funding to prototyping to manufacturing, which is what First Build services, I think, offer.
Yeah, exactly. I'm glad you're familiar with it too. I thought that was a good job of separating, you know, from, like you said, you know, the crowd slack problem of ridiculing the company because what they're trying to do, separating what GE is doing from First Build. Because if you see GE show up on a Kickstarter platform, that just feels weird, right? I'm not expecting that. And I don't know if I should take it seriously or not. What are they doing there? But to create basically what ends up being an innovation lab that's taking products all the way to the market.
Yeah.
That was a smart strategy on their part.
Absolutely. And I think one of the big companies that just likes to go straight to crowdsourcing and crowdfunding is Sony. And they seem to have a level of success. Now,
yeah.
It's kind of a criticism of crowdfunding platforms that it really should be there for untested ideas and not product launches of established companies. However, people seem to love the Pebble smartwatch. As it went back for the third time, it still got a fantastic reception. So, I'm not sure what the expectations are. It seems to be that if you're too big, you're not allowed to use it. But if you're small, you can just continually use it. It's not obvious how the crowd will respond to these things. And I guess that's one of the challenges.
Right. At least it is an opportunity for some feedback. And that's the critical thing we need in product management.
Yes.
So there's some of the issues with crowdsourcing and pros and cons. The other thing that comes up, and I think you have a collection of tools that are addressing prototype work. And as product managers, this depending what industry we're in, this prototype term gets thrown around in very different ways. But I'm using it in the context of like design thinking, where we come up with what we think might be a market we need to serve. We start understanding the consumers in that market better. We start doing some really rough, quick prototypes to iterate our understanding with them about what we have, if it works or not, right? And at some point, that prototype kind of evolves to something that might actually become, you know, pre-production, pre-manufacturing, and then volume manufacturing. What kind of tools do you include and address about this early prototyping work?
I think that's an absolutely critical part of a lot of product development and design. And even for the crowdsourcing and crowdfunding, you often need to have a prototype to be able to get crowdfunding. You can't just have made it up. So one of the tools that I looked at in there, and it's kind of more conceptual in the sense of a tool, it's Hackerspaces, Makerspaces, TechShop, Fab Labs, all those different types of places where, as a product manager and developer, if you have a new idea, what you don't want to do is spend $50,000 to $100,000 buying a machine to produce it in a good quality form. So to actually have a nice prototype, because you may as well just spend that money outsourcing that work to someone else to do it for you who's got that machine. But a way to drive that price down is really Hackerspaces, Makerspaces. And what Hackerspaces and Makerspaces are and usually offer are a collection of machines, CNC mills, 3D printers, lathes, stuff like that. Even in a lot of them, you get high-quality software to design your prototype. And this is really a big innovation drive and risk reducer for product managers and developers who don't have those specific tools. So for like $100 a month, you're able to go along to a Hackerspace or a Makerspace and prototype your idea for merely the cost of your time and the resources and materials that you need. So I think that's a big and important tool that's developed recently around allowing people to gain access to tools that they need to prototype without having to spend a lot of money. So I think that's a really important tool for creating prototypes and something that people often overlook. And the other big part of it that people overlook is the expertise that exists in these Hackerspaces. So going along, it's often a community where you can tap into the people around you and understand, okay, I'm trying to design it like this. Have you got any pointers for me? And you can get a lot of that fantastic feedback and help. Even in that design-led thinking stage, the people around you on the benches can be some of your initial customers. And are you interested in this? Mm-hmm. And you're in a community there that can achieve so much more than when you're on your own.
That's a great way of thinking of it. The two things that those kind of spaces give us is really inexpensive access to sophisticated tools for prototyping work and people who might provide some of the insights for what it is we're trying to innovate with the area in. Because like you said, these people that show up to Makerspaces, often they have deep engineering, backgrounds, and they have a lot of knowledge. And they also might represent our customers that give us some insights on what products might be.
Exactly. And like I said, the real reason behind all these chapters, crowdsourcing, everything like that, so that we don't lose the bigger picture, is really about managing risk. Mm-hmm. So if we go back to crowdsourcing, it's about instead of you investing a huge amount of money and time in a single idea, you maybe have the opportunity to get a lot of ideas, which reduces your risk. With this one, it's about instead of investing a huge amount of money in a single machine, you now have access to multiple Right. machines for a small fee, and you've then again reduced that risk.
Yeah, and that technology changes over so quickly. Why bother buying it if you can use resources of a makerspace that they have a large community they're incentivized to help keep their technology up to date, right? Kind of current.
Exactly.
I have a quick, fun story to tell you that I think you might find interesting. And I talked about this back in my episode 025 that I did at everydayinnovator.com/025. And it was a guy I met. He happened to be working in the office where I was renting some space for a while. And he was the CEO of a golf training company. So they make aids for golfers. They start with the PGA Pro Tour here in America. And they make aids for them to do a better job golfing, right? Better job putting, better job driving, whatever the case is. I was just talking a little bit about what I do, and he goes, oh, I have a product problem. And he had these just two pieces of plastic lying on the floor of his office. He said, I got to find a way to just get these to slide next to each other and be able to make it inexpensively.
Yeah.
And he said, could you help with that? I'm like, well, I'm not really a physical product sort of guy, but I have access to a small design team and we'll see if we can come up with some prototypes for you, right? Mm-hmm. And so I took it to them, had the team, there were seven people available, had them break up into two pairs and one group of three. And they all just churned out quick prototypes on a 3D printer. And we had four prototypes I brought back to him. His initial idea, you know, he was going to, like he has in the past, get molds made and ideally find something he could extrude, since that's an expensive way to get something made. And one of the prototypes he looked at and went, this is really good. Do you think we could just, you know, print these instead of having to go to mold? Mm. And so we, you know, he had everything just 3D printed instead, and using that prototype tool for the prototyping options became actually what was manufactured also.
It's really interesting taking that approach. It was something that may not have been viable a while ago, but HP and a few other companies now have brought out 3D printers that are now becoming so fast and printing objects so quickly that for some products now may or may not make so much sense to go to injection molding or other typical manufacturing processes. So it's a really interesting point, actually.
Yeah, it's changed quickly. The funnest part about the story was my seven designers, the oldest one at the time was 12 years old. So it was just a little class I was teaching, and the kids were great, and they did all the work, and it was pretty cool.
That's awesome.
So we have tools, and making use of things that are already there. The makerspace and hackerspace is really smart. What are some other tools that are wrapped up in this?
So some other tools, again, I'm focusing on that low-risk approach. Mm-hmm. One of the tools I really like in this book is the one on how do we make choices around innovation. And I know this has been one of the chapters that's been discussed quite a lot in the book on the behavioral innovation. And again, it's kind of more conceptual than physical. It looks at really how do we make our choices around innovation and how are they influenced by our biases, by our preconceptions, by all these different factors that make us human beings. And I think this is something that's really important that's often overlooked in the product development and product management, is the decisions we make and how good they are. So what I wanted to do in this chapter was I wanted to push forward a field that just really hasn't seemed to have gone anywhere, and that's of behavioral innovation. And what it is it's an amalgamation of behavioral economics, which is an extremely important and hot topic at the moment, and innovation, which is obviously very hot. And what it does, it looks at combining the two to better understand how do our biases and heuristics affect our decision-making when it comes to innovation. And the specific focus I take in this chapter is in particular on around funding, around investing time and energy into the different innovative activities, new products, new services and everything. So I think it's a really interesting chapter because I would claim the first time it's appeared in a book. So it's the first time you actually see these ideas collected in one place beyond a few sort of white papers, blog posts, and simple things like that. And I wanted to collect the material that was out there and put it in one place and really throw it out there and throw down the gauntlet and say, look, here's this amazing field that's critically important. Let's give it more attention. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of my objective with that chapter as well, to bring it to the forefront that when we make decisions around innovation and product development and product management, it's really those decisions that are critical. So how can we make better decisions? And I think that's an extremely important tool for us to drive better decisions, to lower the risk, and to make sure more of our products are successful because we're simply choosing the right ones.
Yeah, and in that, as you called it, the behavioral innovation and talking about the biases, there has been more written in this last year that's popped up on my radar about the cognitive biases involved in innovation. And that we all see things through our lens of experience.
Exactly.
That clouds our decision-making. Do you have an example of how that impacts an innovation project?
Absolutely. One of the biggest ones is the sunk cost fallacy. And it's really where we invest effort and time into something. And so as it starts failing, we feel it necessary to invest even more effort and time into it. And it's really throwing good money after bad. And it's something that's quite challenging, and I give some solutions around what I think you can do to get around that in my book. But the examples are everywhere of companies that have started developing a product. It hasn't shown its promise as it should have, but because people's reputations are on the line, and even if there are stage gate processes with teeth to say this should be killed, people can be creative and find a way to keep it alive.
Sure.
And so this is, I think, one of the big challenges, something like that. And there are quite a few other ones that I examine in the chapter, things like herding mentalities, where we tend to follow the herd with our product development mm-hmm. and look at kind of what's happening around us and either don't pay enough attention to the herd, which is what Nokia and BlackBerry did, or simply follow the herd blindly over the cliff of sort of insanity and fall down with our products and develop things that just don't make any sense instead of questioning why we're doing what we're doing. And really, I think from a company perspective, this is critical. We might think as individual product developers, that's fine. But when you have the politics and a large corporation around and these decisions are being made, we need to understand how we can make them better, because often people in large companies need to develop products around a strategy that's given to them. And if that strategy is poorly formulated and poorly decided upon based on reasons that aren't good, then I think that's something that can, it doesn't matter how good a process you've got. It's your garbage in, garbage out old motto.
Yeah, it's a really good point. We often have strategy misalignments between the organization strategy and the objectives and what we see as the innovation strategy and how we're approaching innovation. And we may think we have those things lined up, but when it actually comes to putting barriers in place that erode our innovation efforts, we might just recognize that we have some alignment issues there.
Exactly. I think that's the big one. It's like taking a step back and looking at the bigger picture. We might all be the best product developers on the planet, but if, you know, our emotions and if the decision processes are bad in terms of the human side of it, not the protocol side of it, then you can forget everything you've done.
And that herding mentality, you know, that's a fine line. I tend to err on the side of let's understand our customers deeply and find out what their unmet needs are and try to do something that others aren't and not be misled by what others have done. But, you know, your BlackBerry example is a good one of if we don't pay attention to where the market's heading at the same time, we might miss some opportunities there. But if we're just in the business of copying what everyone else is doing, we're not going to really have anything that differentiates ourselves in the marketplace either.
Exactly. And there's been enough studies that have demonstrated that companies that attempt to do fundamentally new products, disruptive innovation, things like that, are more profitable and outperform their peers on the stock market.
Yeah, Apple's really interesting to me, right? At some point, Apple was the cool company, and you were one of the cool kids if you had the Apple device.
Yeah.
Now they've grown up into the large, what looks like the slow-moving company, and I'm not even sure where they're going in terms of the herd anymore.
Yeah.
Interesting to me. So we've talked through a few tools so far together, looked at some crowdsourcing ideas and platforms to support that, both on the funding side and the idea generation side and issues with that, including just the number of ideas we might get and how we manage that going on. Prototyping tools, hackerspaces, makerspaces, really brilliant uses of those to help us really inexpensively approach prototyping. And behavioral innovation, revolving around our biases and decision-making. And what is another tool we should highlight from the book?
I think another important tool that we should definitely consider is probably heading towards the end of the chapter. And this one I'd like to take up simply because it's a different style of tool. It's more around a business model innovation.
Okay.
So as product developers and product managers, we tend to simply focus on, well, not simply, we tend to focus on developing new products and services. However, what we often need to consider is the business model that these products and services are embedded in. Mm-hmm. Is that business model innovative? Is that business model going to produce something better, or have we simply pulled it off the shelf? And what I look at in one of my later chapters is this software as a service paradigm. So I call it X as a service, because really it can be applied to a lot of things nowadays. And it starts with software as a service. You've got hardware as a service, infrastructure as a service, platform as a service. And I ask myself and I ask the reader in the book, where else will this head? For us as product developers in different areas, what can we take away from this? And I look at two really exciting areas, which is medicine as a service and manufacturing as a service. And it explores that idea of what could that mean? Now, doing something as this service, it really has the hallmarks of a few important things, and those are ubiquity. So you can tap into it almost wherever you are. Mm-hmm. Scalability, so you can scale it up as need. Elasticity, so you can, depending on the demand, you can shrink it or increase it. And a few other factors like that. And it's really looking at a few of the industries where these characteristics didn't exist, and watching them enter these industry, and also challenging the reader to say, look, this is happening in these industries that weren't thought of as being industries where you could simply produce a one-off item, for example, in manufacturing at the price and ability that you could if you'd ordered 100,000 of them, or medicine. Can we drive down the cost and just have that on demand as we need? So looking at your industry, challenging the reader, your product or service, can you offer it in this new fashion, this new paradigm? Again, the focus of the book is about reducing risk and lowering that threshold to innovate, so that the idea around this as a service is we want to lower the risk for our customers because we're lowering the price and commitment for them. But it's also look at the platforms out there, the tools for you to offer your service or product in a simple way, taking advantage of perhaps manufacturing as a service, taking advantage of software as a service, and scaling up on someone else's existing infrastructure, your ideas and services that you want to test them on. And I think that's a really important one that people may not think of quickly. They might think, well, I've got to do all this work myself. You don't. You can either tap into the existing infrastructure and use this business model, or you can look at using this business model yourself to make your customers' decision as to whether they're going to use your services. Not an easy one, because it's quite cheap, it's low risk, it's easy for them to test it and scale it up and down. And I think that's an important tool around the business model innovation as well that product developers and product managers should be aware of.
I think there's opportunities across the spectrum in terms of a product's life where business model innovation is important. But it would seem like this would be something that ideally you'd want to consider first, right? What is our business model? How are we going to generate revenue from this? And then let that drive the actual construction of the revenue. Because like you shared, you know, software as a service is very different in its architecture than a traditional, you know, standalone system or client server kind of architecture.
Exactly.
And very different business models that come out of it.
I think that's where I want the reader and what I do different to everyone else in taking that model and saying, well, look, people are applying it in medicine, people are applying it in manufacturing, your industry, how can you apply it and drive a fundamental revolution in the way your products and services are delivered and offered?
Yeah. I wasn't sure that Microsoft was going to be able to make that change as software as a service was getting so dominant. But they seem to be making the transition with Windows 10, which has been provided for free, at least for a period of time. And then they moved Office to a cloud configuration and are taking those steps. And I didn't think they would get there just because it's such a different economic model of taking, you know, small amounts of money over time as opposed to these larger chunks that come in on a more predictable basis.
But I think they see the benefit for consumers. It's easier. And I, like I said, I agree with you. It was an interesting development for me, but we're seeing a lot of interesting innovations coming out of Microsoft, everything from the HoloLens to a lot of the VR activities. So they are, it's not totally surprising. I don't think they've lost their innovation mojo.
I don't think so either. They've kind of become the new cool kids on the block, you know, in some respects.
Yeah.
We'll see what ends up happening between, you know, the big guys of Microsoft and Google and Apple and where we are in a few years. It will be very interesting indeed. And as listeners know, I always love an innovation quote, and I asked for you to share one with us and tell us what it means to you.
So my innovation quote I have today is something that really touches base and ties in a lot of the topics about low-risk innovation, and there's no need to be really risky when innovating, and it is, there is no need to innovate innovation. There exists enough disruptive innovations just waiting to be assembled. And that's something that ties back, I guess, to Thomas Edison and the way he innovated. He just said you need a good imagination and a pile of junk. Mm. And really, I believe that's true. There's a concept for it called technology brokering. And that's where I hope my book also makes a contribution in helping people understand how can we simply take the world around us and use it to innovate and inspire us instead of thinking that we need to go back to some fundamental research and a scientist in a lab fundamentally doing something different. I think there's enough combinations that can be made out of the existing products that exist in the world and made something very disruptive and very innovative. And I really think there's a lot to be said about that and a lot of benefit there. And I think it really focuses on my idea of minimizing that risk. So just finding off-the-shelf products, putting them together and creating disruptive new ideas. So it ties in quite well with my book. It was actually a sentence that unfortunately got cut from the final version.
Interesting.
But it's something that was kind of more a motto I've got in my head, that look, we don't need to sit down and consider the universe when we're trying to innovate. That's not necessary. We can really do disruptive, amazing things from what's around us, with what's around us.
Yeah, sometimes it's just a matter of looking at it from a different perspective, a different lens.
It ties exactly into what you said before about design-led thinking and finding unmet needs and desires and stuff like that. I mean, people talk about the iPhone. It doesn't fit Clayton Christensen's perfect mold of a disruptive innovation, but it, in my eyes, in any definition of disruption that I would have, it should be one of the disruptive forces of this world. So I think it's a good example of a whole heap of technologies that were taken off the shelf, put together in a product in a clever way that had a massive impact.
And that's something Apple is particularly good at. They do their own research and development, but they are masters at taking what exists and packaging it in a very appealing design that provides value to us.
Exactly.
It illustrates well your example. You won't have to look around much. Well, thanks so much for sharing that quote and all the information on the tools from your book. And I am anxious to look through the book in more detail. And can you tell all the everyday innovators listening how to find out about your book and just more about the work you do?
So the book itself, there's a website for it, innovationstoolsbook.com. But if you want to keep up to date, I've got a Facebook page, Innovation Tools Book. You can also follow me, I guess, on Twitter, where I talk every now and then about innovation and innovation tools in the book. I put tweets up about it, but mostly I'll keep you up to date with kind of the important technology events around the world that I think are out there. And that's my Twitter handle's at eShelshir. Otherwise, yeah, send me a tweet, connect with me on LinkedIn, get in touch, post something on the Facebook page, send me a message. More than happy to answer questions. If people grab the book and you want to explore it in further depth, I really enjoy that. I enjoy sort of exchanging the ideas with the readers and seeing where they can take it. The book should serve as a platform for the readers to build something amazing upon. And so I'm always happy to discuss those things with people and to see what type of successes you can make out of these tools and support that as well.
And it's gotten a number of good reviews on Amazon, and I appreciate people taking time to share those reviews, that this is a helpful resource. And I will have those links, Evan, that you just mentioned for everyone listening. They will be on the show notes for this episode to make it easy for you to find the book page and the Facebook page and Twitter handle, eShelshir, and your LinkedIn profile too.
Yep.
So, Evan, thank you so much for taking time and talking about your new book.
It was an absolute pleasure, and I look forward to joining you on the show again.
Thanks for listening. Please tell other product managers and innovators about this podcast. I make that easy. Just go to the show notes for the summary of the discussion with Evan at theeverydayinnovator.com/113. And you'll find the links at the top of the page to share this episode on your favorite social media sites. Also, from that same page, you can download the Product Mastery Roadmap that shows you how to gain influence by going from product manager to product master. Again, that's theeverydayinnovator.com/113. Keep innovating.
Thank you for listening to The Everyday Innovator, which teaches product managers to become product masters. For more resources, please visit our blog at theeverydayinnovator.com.